Certainly.
Then who's playing first?
Who is playing first?
What's playing first?
The what's on second?
I don't know.
He's third base. Third base.
You got an outfield?
Fellow, have anything to do with today's message? Maybe nothing. But as I was preparing for this morning and reading verses around leading up to the verses we read this morning, the confusion between in this conversation with Abbott Costello gave me a little insight to maybe how the disciples and Jesus were feeling in the way they were speaking to each other, the way Jesus was speaking to the disciples prior to our passage about, you will see me, you won't see me, this, and this confusion swirling around in the disciples' minds brought this little skit to mind. And so as we join the disciples in Jesus and Jesus in the verses where Will and Rebecca started reading, I imagine that this might have been the state in which the disciples and Jesus were in this conversation as it began. Jesus begins by saying, I have been using figures of speech with you. The time is coming when I will no longer speak to you in such analogies. Instead, I will speak plainly. And I think when Jesus said this, you might have heard a collective sigh of relief from the disciples. So he continues on, and the disciples say, finally, you're talking so we can understand you. And because you're speaking this way, we believe that you have come from God. Jesus says back to them, now you believe? It's written as a question in most translations, and some people think that it's indicating somewhat of a sarcastic response from Jesus, like, oh, now you believe. Like everything is suddenly clear. Maybe alluding to the fact that they don't fully understand maybe as much as they think they do in that moment. Especially in light of what he's about to tell them. Because he says, look, behold, a time is coming. And actually, that time's right now. So, forewarning, not too much forewarning. You're all going to scatter and abandon me. But I won't be alone because the Father's going to be with me. I'm telling you this so that you're going to have peace in me, even though you're going to experience distress, trials, tribulations, but have courage, be encouraged, because I have overcome the world. At this point, I'm not going to try and speculate what the disciples might be thinking. They have gone from feeling very Abbott and Costello to feeling like things finally made sense, that, and then suddenly Jesus is about to pull the rug out from underneath them. But it's all good because Jesus is going to overcome the world. So maybe they're in a pretty good spot. Or maybe they feel a little bit lost. Maybe they think, well, we've come this far with this man. We'll just keep going a little further. In the verses following the text from this morning, Jesus prays, because this text this morning was following the Last Supper. After the prayer, Jesus and the disciples go to the garden where Jesus is arrested. And in that moment, after the arrest, the trial, the persecution, and the crucifixion, I wonder if any of that conversation with Jesus was in the mind of the disciples. Jesus had just told them, I have overcome the world, but he's dead. What must the disciples be thinking? Do you know that in the years near the birth of Jesus, there were at least a handful of men who made claims of being the Messiah, who sought to overtake the Roman Empire? In 4 BC, there was Simon of Perea, who was promptly beheaded by the Romans. Around the same time, there was a shepherd named Athronges, who claimed to be divinely anointed to liberate the Jewish people. Rome put a stop to him also. Judas, the son of Hezekiah, was actually able to push the Romans out of the city of Sepphoris, which was a town just about four miles away from Nazareth. This, of course, did not make the Romans very happy. So they, in turn, burnt the city to the ground and sold all those inhabitants into slavery, crucifying Judas and 2,000 of his followers, and then left them on the roadside for display. There was also Judas the Galilean, who inspired thousands to follow him, but we read in Acts 5 that he was also put to death. Were the disciples aware of these wannabe messiahs and their fates? Did they really believe that Jesus was the true Messiah, especially now that he was dead? Jesus has told them he conquered the world, yet he made no physical or military pursuits toward Rome. He even spoke against using violence and told Peter to put away his sword at the time of his arrest. So how exactly was Jesus going to save the world? As he was dead. Sometimes it's easy to be critical from our seats 2,000 years removed from the situation. We read in some of the gospel accounts of the disciples hiding in a locked room in fear after Jesus' death. Peter denied knowing Jesus. Well, not long before had they all expressed their belief and trust in him. I have to imagine, though, that if I had any knowledge of these other situations and what had happened to these messiahs and their followers, and Jesus, who I was following, was killed, my first response might be, "Jesus, who?" That doesn't make me or Peter or the disciples bad people. It makes us human. It triggers some flight, fight, or freeze reactions for sure. It doesn't mean that we say, "Jesus, who?" and then walk away. I think it's likely gives us time to consider and process and ponder more about the whole situation without feeling the immediate threat of danger. So that Sunday morning after Jesus' death, the disciples are still reeling from all of this. Jesus had just told them, "I have overcome the world." And then he died, and they don't know what side is up. Mary Magdalene comes back and says, "I've seen Jesus." That probably went over really well. She's crazy. And that evening, Jesus appears to them in their locked room. And he says, "Peace be with you." He doesn't come in and shame them and tell them how disappointed he is in them or what bad people they are, but he offers them a word of peace, one that would likely calm their fears. Unlike the false messiahs, Jesus' claim to overcoming the world didn't die that day in the grave. It was eternally proclaimed when Jesus rose from the grave. With powerful armies, violence, and weapons, Genghis Khan and the Mongol army and the Mongol Empire conquered more than 9 million square miles of the Earth's 57 million square miles. Not even close to overcoming the world. It was Jesus who the world looked at as powerless, as the one who indeed overcame the world. How does that shape our understanding of power? At the VIA meetings, we talk about using our power. Not something I was really comfortable with when I first started working with VIA. We often think of power as bad, with many allegations of abuse of power. We try and steer clear from power or having the appearance of power sometimes. But the very basic and first definition of power is the ability to act or produce an effect. The reality is power in and of itself is not bad, scary, or wrong. What we often see, though, is power being used to harm and push others down in an effort to elevate one's own self. Jesus, in fact, was not powerless, but chose to use his ability to act, to show love. And the effect he produced was more love. Love that conquered the world. How mind-blowingly amazing is that? We're so used to the negative effects of power that we sometimes forget how full of love power can actually be. Because of Jesus' powerful and all-consuming love, we too get to be part of this story of overcoming the world. In 1 John 5, it says, "Everyone who is born of God defeats the world. And this is the victory that defeated the world, our faith." Who defeats the world? Isn't it the one who believes that Jesus is God's son? We've heard it before, and we'll hear it again, because we can never hear it too much. It's a love story. Our story, God's story, the story where love really can conquer all. Judith Jones, a vicar in the Episcopal Church, reflects on these verses in 1 John 5 by saying this: "Truly Christian faith conquers the world, not by military might or doctrinal arguments or coercion, but by love. Christians believe in the Son of God, who rather than shedding the blood of others to prove that he was the Messiah, allowed his own blood to be shed. God's children triumph not by inflicting suffering on others or by avoiding pain at all costs, but by allowing God to work within and through them, even in their suffering." What applies to individual Christians applies also to the church community. The church triumphs over false teaching not by force or argument, but because of and through the suffering love of the crucified Messiah. This is the truth to which the Holy Spirit testifies. God's Son was tortured and broken for us. This is the faith that overcomes the world. God's love brings life, even out of brokenness and death. This is the victory to which we are called. Loving God's children, thus living our faith in the crucified, risen Son of God. End quote. Our belief in Jesus and his love for us, a love that led him to the cross, that love that never ends, the love is the foundation of our relationship with ourselves, with others, with Jesus, and with God. That love is the power that allowed Jesus to overcome the world. And that is good news for all.